Again, an organization ready to hand the Masonic organization, for instance, is organized like an army against the church. And here I may digress to remark that, in point of fact, the Masonic body is throughout the world an enemy of the Catholic Church and active in seeking her destruction, nor is there any difference in its activity between one country and another, save that it is naturally more in evidence in a country where Catholicism is strong than in a country where it is weak. It is beside the mark to plead that it has no connection, hostile or other, with the faith, that its elaborate Jewish ritual nowhere contradicts a Catholic doctrine, that its inculcation of good fellowship and its many charities, its arrangements for mutual aid among its members, are indeed consonant with the Catholic idea of charity. All that has nothing to do with plain fact which stares us all in the face throughout the world, that Masonry acts as an enemy of Catholicism, where Catholicism is very weak, as in England, the hostility is negligible. But exactly the same lodges are far from negligible in Ireland, and in the United States that hostility is prominent in almost exact proportion to the local strength of the church. Where she is very strong it is rampant. Where the Catholic body is weak it is less noticeable. Where Catholics are negligible in numbers it disappears. In the Catholic nations France, Italy, Belgium and Spain the hostility of Freemasonry is a commonplace, and the programs for the destruction of the church, drawn up in the lodges, are available for all to read. I have heard it advanced that the origin of the quarrel lies not with Masonry, but with the Church itself, which, in denouncing on principle all secret societies, has put itself voluntarily in conflict with the powerful corporation of Masonry and must face the consequence. That is debatable, but the fact of universal hostility cannot be doubted. So much for this digression on a most important side issue. Let us resume our examination of the anti-clerical. Anti-clericals find themselves inevitably allied with all forms of antagonism to the Catholic Church, with opposing religions and corporations, with all those to whom the faith is an offense. Meanwhile, from a theoretical attitude of neutrality, sincere enough in its original holders, there is bred in them and their descendants, through the exasperation of the quarrel, a definitely hostile attitude towards the Church which brings them nearer to her vowed enemies. At last you have two armies opposed one to the other among the directing classes at least, the first avowedly and definedly Catholic, having attached to them not a few who, from sympathy with tradition, support the faith politically, although they do not accept it in their hearts. The second, men determined by every means in their power subject to safeguarding some remnants of consistency with their old doctrine of neutrality to destroy the Catholic Church root and branch. When that state of affairs has been arrived at, it is win or lose. It is a clear battle between the Church and her enemies, and that is the situation today. Anti-clericalism means today the fruit of anti-clericalism, its maturity. And, as such, there is a duel to the death between her and that evil fruit. One unforeseen consequence of this final black and white contrast is the disappearance of that once large body of men who attempted to reconcile the fashionable liberalism of their day with the claims of that church to which they are so truly attached. These men had said for years that the elementary school, for instance, though neutral and avoiding even the mention of our Creator, was not thereby definitely hostile and might well be accepted. They have continued to say it sounded reasonable to them that though the prelates of the Catholic Church were not admitted to official ceremonies, yet that was but a point of civic procedure, that the great thing was to convert society again to a universal Catholic spirit and not to trouble about details of etiquette. But the facts have become too strong for them. A battle is by this time engaged, which a man must be upon one side or the other. And when in the last development of anti-clericalism the movement becomes explicitly one for the destruction of the faith, they will divide. Some will rally to reality, begin to forget the empty formulas of political theory, and consider and serve the faith alone. The rest will be as frankly opposed to the faith, root and branch, as any other of its avowed enemies. There, put as briefly as I can put it, is the development of anti-clericalism, and we must never forget that it is present, and will be present for a long time to come, wherever the Catholic Church was maintained as the dominant religion of the people after the great catastrophe of the Reformation. The struggle has had universal effects on the life of Europe and the world. 20 years ago it turned the world upside down over the Dreyfus business, destroyed the intelligence department of the French army, which was transferred to the police, gave us, as an ultimate result, the Great War, and, in consequence, the perilous economic condition of England today. After the Great War, it presided at the portioning of the world. There was a moment when it hung by a thread whether Bavaria should not be joined with Austria to form a Danube state. But Clemens cried, "What, another Catholic state in Europe? No, thank you, Poland is quite enough." And Prussia gained the prize. Certainly, most certainly, anti-clericalism concerns us all, even those who live in sheltered Catholic minorities under the protection of Protestant governments and who are to the raging battle between the Church and the world as boats in harbor are to the wild sea outside. But that battle is not yet won by one or other side. The story is not concluded. What we have to remember is, in all our inquiry into the position of the Church today, that throughout the nations of Catholic culture the Church is thus imperiled with risks quite different from her dangers in the non-Catholic culture. There is internecine war, for in the nations of Catholic culture the Church will never accept a position of inferiority or the fiction that she is but a tolerated fragment. If she goes down, she will go down still fighting for a Catholic society and Catholic laws. So far the process has led to a very disparate result. In France, anti-clericalism holds the field, triumphantly and yet precariously. It is done by preventing the women from voting, by rejecting the family vote, of course, and through the anti-clerical grasp of all state machinery, administration by anti-Catholic officials, the imposition of the anti-Catholic spirit by state teachers in a compulsory educational system, filling of posts in the higher education with anti-Catholics, and the provision of anti-Catholic history, with the same doctrine governing all public examinations, the checking of promotion of Catholics in as many of the professions as can be influenced directly or indirectly by the state. But the political cliques which act thus stand for only a minority of the nation, and not a very secure minority. Their preoccupation with attack upon the Church has weakened them further. They have created, wantonly, the Alsatian trouble. They came within an ace of ruining the currency. The basis upon which they and the French parliamentary faction reposes weakens from day to day. It is confusedly at issue with the average man. At any moment, so far, the whole structure might crumble, but its directors rely upon the slow and persistent effects of anti-Catholic education in the elementary schools and upon the economic policy of starving the Church through lack of endowment, coupled with a vigilant repression of that main organism for the propagation of the faith, the religious teaching orders. There is something in their contention. There is ground for anxiety lest and that soon they prove right in their conjecture that victory will ultimately be theirs and the faith reduced in France to a fragment of the people unable to give tone to the whole. After so many years of their action over education and political reward, the anti-Catholic effort is beginning to be felt throughout the nation at large. It is apparent to the wise in its remote effects upon art, letters, building, all the externals of a civilization in jeopardy. It is apparent in the national temper and manners. It is also apparent already in a more obvious form, the loss of practice. I have seen districts in France which might be called de-Catholicized. At any rate, they were districts where the ordinary practices of religion had so far declined as to be familiar to but a very small minority, and the sight suggests a coming generation in which, throughout considerable spaces of the countrysides, that tradition upon which all their civilization is based will be lost. Herein lies both the interest and peril of the situation. Parliamentary government will always be detested by the French because the French cannot bear oligarchy, even in an aristocratic form, let alone in a form which has no social sanction and has become frankly ridiculous as well as odious. But parliaments in France may well continue, and if they continue, the official forces adverse to the survival of the faith will grow, for the official machine wills it so. The apologetic for religion is, I fancy, better carried on in France than in any other modern country. There is active opposition to the official anti-Catholic stuff in history, for instance, such as you get nowhere else, and there is an increasing volume of powerful literature which is in sympathy with, and based upon, the Catholic traditions of the country. All this means that the intelligence of the nation tends to return towards Catholicism. But how far does this tendency affect the mass of the people? Undoubtedly it affects the towns more than the country. But how far does it affect even the towns? That is the essential question, and it is one not easy to answer. We shall be better able to answer it at the end of another 20 years. So far the position is still doubtful, but it is menacing and disquieting. If after this critical passage in balance between political anti-Catholicism in France and the solid culture of the nation, the weight begins to fall to the Catholic side, the effect upon the political fortunes of Catholicism throughout the world will be very great. If it falls upon the other side and the faith sinks in France to be a separated minority of the people, the effect of that will not be confined to France either. It will be felt throughout the world. For it is an invariable rule in the history of our race that the spiritual direction of the Gauls should be an index of general movements outside of their boundaries. They determined the triumph of the Trinitarians. They enlarged the papacy. They gave Calvinism to the world and with it the core of dissension. In the struggle of the Reformation they were at one moment far nearer losing tradition than was Britain. Their recovery of the faith determined, humanly speaking, the survival of religion. Their enthusiasm for the revolutionary trend transformed all Europe. Their effect on thought and action remains, though it be negative and an example of decline. That decline will color all our world. Therein lies the intense, the perilous interests of the French scene. France determines, or at least chiefly influences, and so far France lies in the balance. But a survey of the Catholic culture as a whole very strongly supports the repeated epigram of the last years, that the tide has turned in Europe. In Spain and Italy, with vigorous efforts, the anti-clerical advance has been checked, and by this time reversed. The thing was done first long ago in Spain, and was more directly religious there. If the happy destruction of the parliamentary oligarchy in that country has confirmed the good tendency, we may be fairly certain that whatever military struggles a monarchic system brings in its train, the politicians at least will not trouble Spain again. And with that sort absent anti-clericalism droops, for a parliamentary clique is its necessary agent. As all the world knows, the thing has been done even more thoroughly in Italy. It is the rather connected with a general civil policy than with any special preoccupation with religion, but reaction towards religion is strong and fully supported. It is particularly to be noted that the Masonic Corporation is, for the first time in history, subjected to the general law against secret societies and prevented from acting as one. As a consequence, anti-clericalism, the very note of all official action between the creation of modern Italy and the Great War, is stricken with the palsy. It does not follow that new and difficult perils may not there arise for the faith. But they will hardly arise from the old anti-clerical side. It seems to be finally and definitely defeated. Spain and Italy stand in our day both of them emancipated from one great evil of their past. In both those countries the reaction against anti-clericalism is successful and established. In Poland anti-clericalism has not gathered momentum. To the traveler it is hardly apparent, though it is potentially present and a few powerful individuals are certainly sympathetic with it. The past of the country, its crucifixion at the hands of Prussia and Russia in each case with hatred of the Catholic Church for a main motive, has identified the religion, so far, with the nation, and that effect remains. It is perhaps the same with anti-clericalism in Ireland. Though there, of course, there is a much larger anti-Catholic body than in Poland, anti-clericalism proper would seem not yet to have attained any corporate being. As in Poland, the forces of nationalism and the effect of recently passed history strongly support the faith. The citizens of both those recently emancipated countries would, I think, in general proclaim the impossibility of any strong anti-clericalism among them in the near future, but beyond that judgment a foreigner cannot go. 3. The modern mind. The third and far the most formidable element of main opposition to the faith today, is what I propose to call by its own self-appointed and most misleading title, the modern mind. How misleading and false that title is, I will discuss in a moment, premising here, that I adopt it only because terms are necessary to discussion, and this is the admitted and well-known term ready to hand. Were I to invent a new one, I should hamper my argument, for it would be unfamiliar. We note that it acts in a fashion wholly negative. It is not an attack, but a resistance. It does not, like anti-clericalism, exercise an active effect opposed to religion, nor, like nationalism, substitute a strong counter-emotion which tends to supplant religion. It rather renders religion unintelligible. Its effect on religion is like that of an opiate on the power of analysis. It dulls the faculty of appreciation, and blocks the entry of the faith. Hence its power. We further note that it is of far more effect in the Protestant than in the Catholic culture, though common to both. In the former it is discovered higher up in the intellectual and social scale than in the latter, and is very widespread. In the latter it is more restricted in area and less accepted by the educated classes. But everywhere it is of the same character, and everywhere so far as its influence extends, it fills with despair those who attempt to deal with its fearful incapacities. And even before they can deal with it at all, they are brought up against the absence of a language to effect their end. For, indeed, we are met at the outset of this, perhaps the most important section of our inquiry, by a difficulty which was not known in any other time than ours, that difficulty to which I have alluded, that this chief adverse condition we have to examine has no suitable name. There is no fixed term or definition for that major factor in our present difficulties, the spirit which is everywhere a main adversary of the Catholic Church, and peculiar to our generation. Many a name has been attempted, none has been found satisfactory. And there is legitimate complaint against all those which have hitherto been loosely used for the thing in question. That mood running through the lower masses of the modern world, of wide influence, therefore, in Europe and America, and rapidly spreading to the traveled or westernized in the Mahometan and pagan cultures, is baffling to label. That name which its own victims use and which I here adopt, the modern mind or modern thought, is a misnomer, because it ignorantly begs the question of universality. It presupposes that those suffering from the disease are the mass of our contemporaries and those free from it a negligible exception. Of course, it is not so. Most modern men do not feel this spirit. No Catholic feels it at least, no Catholic who cares to remain Orthodox. The greater part of really cultivated men outside the Catholic Church despise it, and everything traditional and solid in our civilization, notably, the peasantry of agricultural countries, leaves it to one side. Nevertheless, as it is the word its own votaries use, I will here call it by the name but in inverted commas. I will speak of it as the modern mind, but emphasizing continually as I do so the falsity of the term. If we call it as some do realism, we are confused by the use of that term with a precise and profound meaning in true philosophy where it signifies the reality of ideas as opposed to nominalism. We are also confronted by the disturbing fact that, even in the conversational sense of the word, the spirit of which I speak is the very opposite of recognizing the real world. It is a spirit all print and tags, all soaked in ready-made phrases which have been swallowed whole, without the least examination, by minds incapable of criticism. Were we to call it modernism, we should be nearer the mark. But unfortunately that word has already been assigned to a definite theological school of error, whereas the spirit of which I speak is something far more extended, vaguer and, indeed, of more effect, for modernism in the technical sense of the word is pretty well dead, but the spirit of which I speak is very much with us. We all know the thing. It is the spirit which tells us, on hearing any affirmation or hypothesis not within its own limited experience, that the affirmation or hypothesis must be false. It is the spirit especially prone to take for granted the falsity of an unfamiliar idea if that idea is known to have been familiar in the past. It is the spirit which confuses development and complexity with the growth of good and the process of time with the process of betterment. It is the spirit which appeals, as to a final authority, to whatever has last been said in a matter, the latest authority. It is the spirit which has lost acquaintance with logical form and is too supine to reason. It is the spirit which lives on bad science and worse history at third hand. It is the spirit, not of the populace or of the scholars, but of the half-educated. What may be the causes of this philosophical disease, and it is an appalling one which is affecting such large numbers in our time, I shall consider later. Here I propose first to analyze its character. Upon dissecting it we discover the modern mind to contain three main ingredients and to combine them through the force of one principle. Its three ingredients are pride, ignorance, and intellectual sloth. Their unifying principle is a blind acceptance of authority not based on reason. Pride causes those who suffer from this disease to regard whatever they think they have learned, whatever they have absorbed, through no matter how absurd a channel, as absolute and sufficient. Ignorance forbids them to know with any thoroughness what men have discovered about these things in the past, and how certainly. Intellectual sloth forbids them to examine an argument, or even to appreciate the implications of their own assertions. With most men who are thus afflicted, the thing is not so much a mixture of these vices as the mere following of a fashion, but these vices lie at the root of the mental process in question. As to the principle of blindly accepting an authority not based on reason, it runs through the whole base affair and binds it into one. Fashion, print, iteration, are the commanders abjectly obeyed and trusted. Let us take a leading test, the attitude taken by the modern mind towards the supernatural, the shrine, the inhabiting spirit, and, particularly, towards miracle. Witness has been born to a certain marvel, a thing outside ordinary experience, the spirit of which I speak will deny, not the actual occurrence upon this or that good intellectual ground as of insufficient evidence, or what not, but the very possibility of the marvel, and it will repose that denial upon something presumed with regard to the physical universe, which presumption it accepts as intelligently as a fetish worshipper will accept his African idol. It will tell you that a mumbo-jumbo which it calls science has achieved in the knowledge of reality or whatever lies behind the phenomena of matter a final apprehension which in fact physical science never has achieved, and never can, because such apprehension cannot be attained by men's saint measurements and observations of the phenomena alone. And note that this spirit is removed by depths from that old and grander, now disappearing thing, the true scientific negation of a lifetime ago, that proceeded from men who abused knowledge, but who had knowledge and who possessed a philosophical method. This proceeds from mere assertion based on something hurriedly read or heard. Again, this spirit, this modern mind, will refer to all transcendental belief in terms which imply the inferiority of the past to the present, that is, of other peoples and epochs to the vain man-saint tone epoch. It will call such faith reactionary, or medieval, or exploded. It will tell you that the creed belongs to an uncritical age, and in saying so it will show its own ignorance of all that vast mass of intellectual work with which the past of Europe was filled, and of the almost equal mass of high modern work in defense of supernatural experience. The color in which the whole of the modern mind is dyed is essentially stupidity. It will not think, and that is a very strange weakness for anything which calls itself a mind. If it were an active enemy, its lack of reason would be a weakness, being alas, not active, but a passive obstacle. Like a bog, it is none the weaker for being thus irrational. I have said that its unifying principle was the acceptation of false authority, blind faith divorced from reason. The modern mind takes for granted without examination a number of first principles as, for instance, that there is a regular progress from worse to better in the centuries of human experience, or that parliamentary oligarchies are democratic, or that democracy is obviously the best form of human government, or that the object of human effort is money and that the word success means the accumulation of wealth. Having taken these things for granted, without examination, it goes ahead cheerfully under the illusion that its opponents have the same ideas. What is more, it betrays that extraordinary ability for disbelieving the evidence of own and own senses which is the mark of unintelligent fanaticism. It will gaze upon that most hideous of human prospects, the industrial town, and compare it favorably with a medieval city, Huddersfield, with Sinna. It will call a society wealthy when a great part of its inhabitants are half starving. It will believe any new hypothesis in physical science to be ascertained fact, though it has assisted at the destruction of half a dozen other such hypotheses within the last 50 years. I have said that this odd habit of preferring long words picked up in the newspapers to the evidence of own senses is essentially fanatical, and indeed the whole of this mood may be seen in the singular phenomenon that the certitudes of the modern mind seem to vary in inverse proportion to the direct sensible evidence available. For instance, its victims will be far more sure of the existence of vitamins than they are of a nasty-tasting chemical beer. They will be far more sure of electrons than of fresh eggs. And when the electron or the vitamin bursts in its turn, tomorrow or the day after, and is supplanted by the whatnot, They will accept the whatnot with equal simplicity and fervor. Why is this mood so dangerous to the Catholic Church? That patently it is so, we see. It inhibits men from the so much as understanding what the faith may be, and bars the action of a true authority by the unquestioned acceptation of false. We can see it doing that every day before our eyes. But in what, we may ask, is it a peril? It is a peril because true faith is based upon reason, and whatever denies or avoids reason imperils Catholicism. There is nothing more inimical to the faith than this abandonment of thought, this dependence upon a great number of fixed postulates which men have not examined, but have accepted upon mere printed affirmation, and by the brute effect of repetition. Well, then, the modern mind is essentially opposed to Catholic action because it is unreasoning. But why so powerful? Why should this spirit, however strong to move the indignation of the wise or the impatience of the common sense populace, have also such special weight with the more shallow of our time? I think the explanation lies in the fact that the dupes of this fashion believe it to be based upon evident proof which the least capable could, if he chose, test for himself. Here I must introduce the last consideration which may complete our understanding of the unpleasant thing, I mean, a consideration of its origins. The modern mind is the dregs of certain much nobler forces of the past, some of which still drag on as survivals, others of which are dead. It is the base product of a better ancestry. By one line it descends as a degraded bastard from that high scientific negation of a generation now passing, the survival we have already examined. By another, it derives, ludicrously enough, from the clear-headed skeptical rationalists, by another from the great republicans of the 18th century. In its puerile metaphysic it is but misunderstanding the strong scientific agnostics of the past. The modern mind is confirmed in its folly by the fixed idea that someone or other somewhere proved its errors to be truths and that the proof was final and obvious. This attitude of the modern mind is due to that great advance in those forms of knowledge which are based, as we saw in the matter of the old scientific negation, on exact measurement, the physical sciences and the close examination of documents. Of such measurements we make today many thousands where our fathers not 100 years ago made but a score. The practice has given us a novel and astonishing collection of powers over the physical universe, and not a few though much more doubtful discoveries upon the nature and origin of classical and medieval texts. At the same time, abused, it can without a doubt paralyze intelligence, and the modern mind is the poor product of its abuse, or rather, the confused memory of an abuse committed by greater men, immensely superior to it. So the modern mind, when it undertakes any activity which is not often confines itself to physical science. Anyone can measure accurately over and over again, anyone can catalogue points in a document or carry on a series of experiments. It needs no effort of the intelligence. So, when the results are reaped, the fallacy is easily entertained that because so much can be done without the use of the reason, therefore the reason may be despised. At the same time, the habit of proof by minute and exact measurement deadens the sense of proof by other methods, and, as we are unhappily aware when we look around us, it paralyzes the sense of beauty. In themselves the habits necessary to an expansion in physical science are admirable, for they are instruments in the noble search after truth, and in that discovery of reality which is the chief business of mankind. But when they are isolated and take a false place of their own to the exclusion of the higher powers of the soul, they may inflict mortal injury. Such injury has been inflicted in the class of which I speak, a stratum neither of the people nor of the humanists, but somewhere in between, has come, especially in our chaotic industrial towns, to believe that repeated and certain experiment producing proof of regular material sequence applies not only as it does to physical science, but to all things. They are the heirs of the high scientific despair of older days, but the unworthy and illiterate heirs. They make no reservations. They attempt no coordinated system. They simply believe. They have further come to hold, vaguely but firmly, that sundry men whose names they hear quoted are infallible authorities, because they are said to have discovered this, that, and the other. Hence is it today that whether you are discussing the authenticity of a gospel or a Greek poem, the excellence of a picture, or the greatness of a nation, you find yourself presented by such men, at best, with statistics commonly irrelevant, or, at the worst, with the mere name of some man competent in his own sphere, but in the sphere under debate quite incompetent. To all this the modern mind has added an ethic of whose origin it never heard, but which has for its author come. It is the worship of humanity, and of humanity mortal. That is good which makes men happier here or looks as though it might, and happier, not mainly through the satisfaction of justice nor even by a search for beauty, but in seeking things much more tangible and perishable, mainly of the body. And this worship of ourselves in the place of God is heavily reinforced by nationalism on the one hand, by the communist cry for economic equality on the other. Much else enters into the formation of the modern mind. It is the dregs of that too simple creed launched or confirmed by the French philosophers of the Encyclopedia. It is the dregs of that German monism and that German pantheism which so much affected the 19th century. It is the dregs of fatigue in an over-complex civilization, and it suffers the organized propagation of myth, especially in the matter of man's saint unknown origins. But in the main the source of this modern disease is the false application of mechanical methods, inapplicable to higher spheres of thought, which it couples with that ethic of positivism, the worship of humanity. Such are the sources. But the modern mind is far from its sources and settled into something much lower than the dead or dying ideas from which it drew its own lack of ideas, much less than the philosophies on which it bases its lack of philosophy. Note in connection with the modern mind its inability to state its own position. The old-fashioned agnostic laid down definitely a dogma, and a dogma worth listening to. He said, "There may be something, on the whole I think there is something, but we cannot know what it is. The organs by which alone we can know anything tell us nothing about that something, so let us, like honest men, proclaim our ignorance of that something." The pure skeptic had a somewhat different position, and on the whole, a better one. He said, "How do we know anything? We cannot even affirm our own selves, for personality it is a variable thing, a function of time and memory, mysteries no man can sound. Let us not pretend to know anything at all. The day of such honest men is past, or they are dwindled to a little band. Those who oppose the faith today as devotees of the modern mind cannot tell us what they themselves believe. After we have made every allowance for the natural desire to shirk the consequences of unbelief, or not to lose income, it remains a wonder that they cannot tell us what they believe. And this applies not to them alone, but also to the better minds who stoop to flatter them." Read this. The real trend of religion among the younger generation is away from dogmatic and institutional Christianity, and towards an individual and personal faith resting not on authority but on new Protestantism is not relativist in the objects of its faith. It believes that truth is absolute, and that God is unchanging, but it accepts the necessity of growth and change in our beliefs. We must sit very loose to tradition, and keep our minds open. Our anchor is what used to be called the testimony of the Holy Spirit, which assures us of the reality and primacy of those eternal values which Christ came to reveal. This is the true Christianity, and we need not be discouraged about its prospects of victory if we look for them in the fruits of the Spirit, and not in institutional statistics or successes of organization. Was ever such a mass of verbiage? There is no rhyme or reason in it, not one definite statement of doctrine, save that God is unchanging, followed by the necessity of change in our beliefs. Therefore, of course, a change in our belief that God is unchanging. Strange rigmarole. What are the eternal values that Christ came to reveal? No answer. What is sitting loose to tradition? In what degree, where erred, how may traditions be a guide? No answer. What is that experience which, though an experience, has no authority? No answer. What has he to say against a personal experience of the value of authority? No answer. What is Christianity? No answer. How does it carry on without institutions? No answer. Yet it is from the pen of Dean Inge, a man whose whole public standing is that of one criticizing religious doctrine from the superior plane of our modern advance in knowledge, and that pen, when it deals with any other matter than religion, is as precise as any now writing and as clear. I would not accuse such an intelligence as his from suffering the collapse of the modern mind, but he panders to it. He has an eye on the readers of his journalism. There stands the modern mind, a morass. The great difficulty of the intelligent in dealing with this thing, whether they be Catholic or skeptical, is the lack of hold. It is like fighting smoke. It affords a commentary on the famous tag that with stupidity the gods themselves will wrestle in vain. What are you to do with a man who always argues in a circle, who tells you that some political arrangement is good because it is democratic, and when you ask whether it is as a fact democratic, why democracy is an evident good, answers you by saying that you are sinning against democracy and its holy name? What are you to do with a man who does not recognize his own first principles, who tells you that he believes a thing on the authority of a name or a bit of print, and who, when you ask him the grounds of his confidence in such, answers you by giving another name and another bit of print? What are you to do with a man who uses the same word in different senses during the same discussion, as, for instance, who says he believes in evolution, meaning growth which all men believe in, and in the same sentence make it mean if the bestial origin of man's saint body, which is probable enough, be Darwin's saint theory of mechanical natural selection, which is as dead as a doornail? What are you to do with a man who puts it forth as a foundation for debate that the human reason is no guide, and who then proceeds to reason through hundreds of pages on that basis? Yet all that, and hundreds of derivatives therefrom, make up the horrible welter of the modern mind. Well, we must hope that intelligence will resume its rights, even against such, but the prospect is not cheerful. Meanwhile, the monstrous apparition of the modern mind has produced one good among many evils. It has produced a belated brotherhood of the intelligent. We of the faith and the cultured pagans have a common opponent, a common donkey blocking the car, and needing to be shouldered off the lane into the ditch, breeds fellow feeling between the Catholic and the clear-minded skeptic. Each feels a peculiar disgust with the modern mind. So we have, at last, allies. The modern mind feeds, the animal is nourished or it could not live. All moods must thus receive regular sustenance or perish. What is the food which aliments the modern mind? It absorbs two forms of nutrition, one from the imposed elementary school, one from the popular press. Between them they secure the continuity and permanence of the modern mind. These two instruments were unknown to the past. They are of strong effect on the present. They are of effect throughout the whole of the modern European and American world, and their effect is increasing. I will state them in their order. The first thing to be said about universal compulsory instruction as it is now arranged is that it is necessarily at issue with the Catholic conception of society, because it sets out upon a first principle which the Catholic conception of society denies. That is not a judgment agreeable to modern fashion, but it is true. And before we consider the particular way in which this institution sustains the modern mind, we must appreciate how and why it necessarily clashes with that faith to which the modern mind is now the principal obstacle. This first principle upon which universal compulsory instruction is based is the idea that a certain minimum of instruction in a certain category of learning is the first essential to right living. Other things come after, but a knowledge of these, at least, is indispensable to man and society, and must therefore be imposed on all by force. This category includes letters, that is, reading and writing, elementary arithmetic, by which ordinary civic occupations are carried on, some very general knowledge of the past and of contemporary nations, their geography and character, the whole tinctured with the today inevitable religion of nationalism and a vague general ethic, humanitarian and therefore unwittingly positivist. -.